I will begin by introducing our panelists, and then they will each give a brief 5-minute commentary on the subject, after which we'll begin to entertain questions. I'll kick off those questions, but we ask that you also fill out, I think you have these forms, and when you filled them out, raise your hand so that our folks can come down the aisle and collect them and bring them up here and participate. So first, I'm just going to go from my from left to right, no particular political significance there. My friend Les O'Coin is a former journalist and professor of government and 9-term U.S. congressman from Oregon. In retirement, he was the Glenn Jackson Professor of Government and Business Ethics at Southern Oregon University in Ashland for 8 years. When he retired from Congress, Les was 84th in overall seniority in the House, the dean of the Oregon delegation and a Democratic whip, and you served with our own Pat Williams as well for most of that time. His political memoir, To Catch and Release, which shows you that he did live in Bozeman for some time, is scheduled to be published by the Oregon State University Press in the fall of next year. We also are very pleased to have to welcome Will Dobson, who is NPR's chief international editor. He leads a team of correspondents across the globe committed to delivering powerful stories and authoritative reporting on international politics, economics, and culture. Dobson is the author of The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy, a theme relevant tonight, I think, which examines the struggle between authoritarian regimes and the people who challenge them. And finally, Dr. Jeff Reed, I believe a Montanan, is a tech executive who has worked for Fortune 500 and startup environments in both chief information officer and chief technology officer capacities for the last 30 years. His current focus is in security software, the Internet of Things, or IoT, and machine learning and artificial intelligence. He has published multiple books and scientific articles on linguistic theory. He donates his time and money to any activity or group that uses education to pass on the appreciation and hence conservation of wild places in the Upper Yellowstone watershed. Let's welcome our panelists. And we'll go in the order in which they were introduced. So Les, let's hear your 5-minute.
Well, Frankie, thank you very, very much. And I want to thank the Bozeman Library and its foundation for hosting this event tonight. And most of all, I want to thank all of you for such a wonderful turnout as we gather to discuss an issue that really goes to the heart of self-rule and our democratic values. First, let's note that we've entered into, as a country, a period in which, in my judgment, the next few elections may well define our democracy's future. Yet this comes at a time when political illiteracy is greater than I can remember. And I can remember back a long way, Frankie, because I turned 76 on Sunday. 72, okay. One major reason for the political fog in our country, but not the only one, is fake news and the confusion it sows among citizens who are trying to make rational judgments and choices for themselves and their community. I'd like to talk about that for a moment. A poll just out shows that 7 in 10 Americans think mainstream media peddles fake news. Not all the time, but too much of the time. The trouble is they aren't sure if what they're reading or watching at the moment is fact or fiction. 71%. Which means that a large number of Americans, my friends, often feel in the dark about or distrustful of facts about daily life in this democracy. I call this an existential danger to democratic self-rule. David Souter, the former Supreme Court Justice, put it very well, I think. He wrote, "An ignorant people can never remain a free people." He added that even, quote unquote, passive ignorance can lead America into an authoritarian state. Now, I think it's important to see the problem we're talking about in a wider frame. That framework, in my mind, in my judgment, is America's current ideological civil war that is being fought out as we divide ourselves up into tribes and use information as weapons against each other. If TV networks other than Fox are, for example, fake news networks, quote unquote, if the mainstream media is the enemy of the people, if any criticism of a politician is fake news, then the politician cannot be held accountable for his or her actions, a democratic hallmark. And two, the politician wants to be your only oracle of truth. History is filled with strong men who held such power. Well, what can we do about it? We'll examine that tonight. Here are some of my views. The main one is this: we can't curb freedom of speech. That cure, in my judgment, is worse than the disease. If we lose that freedom, we'll have lost all hope for democracy, which depends not on thought police, but on the informed consent of the governed. The real remedy, then, in my mind, is to foster the ABCs of critical thinking. Evaluate sources of your information. Read widely. Look for logical fallacies. Of course, the best incubators for critical thinking are our schools, from junior high all the way up. Unfortunately, and as a sad commentary, state and federal governments have been disinvesting in education for years. Support your schools. Lobby for improved civic education. And don't forget your libraries, which sponsor events and forums like this. In my remaining time, I want to turn to a similar problem: the weaponization of political speech. It parallels both fake news and the poison it has on the body politic. I'm talking about political rhetoric designed not to inform, but to divide Americans. One of Newt Gingrich's contributions to our ideological civil war was a two-part vocabulary list he sent to right-wing candidates across the country who, quote-unquote, want to talk like Newt on the campaign stump. One part of the vocabulary list offers words for his candidates to use to describe themselves. On the other list are words he wants his candidates to use against their opponents. Words for his candidates include opportunity, morality, incentive, courage, strength, freedom, prosperity. Words for the opponents, they include liberal, decay, failure, radical, corruption, sick, pathetic, treasonous. You know, if any of you then hear a candidate, keeping all of this in mind, talk about mobilizing a crusade against liberal anti-family decay threatened by a cynical power broker, corrupt machine bosses, and an obsolete, self-serving, unionized bureaucracy, then you at least know the author's identity. You'll also know that you've got a front row seat in the information wars that are vexing our country. Because in rhetoric, as in fake news, language sets the terms of debate. Once you've set the terms, you have half the battle won. Forewarned is forearmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Les. And we'll hear from Will and your views of fake news and
thank
free
you.
Speech.
Thank you very much. First, I just want to say thank you to the organizers for this event, the Bozeman Public Library, the Symposium Committee, all of you for coming out tonight. And in particular, I want to thank Janae and Kit for inviting me. It was an extraordinary invitation to be able to participate in something like this. And I have to tell you, this is my first time in Bozeman, and for that matter, even my first visit to Montana. And yes, it is. And I get it. I mean, wow. I only got here on Sunday, and I had a wonderful day yesterday at Yellowstone. We had an incredible, I mean, it was an incredible 12 hours there, and that was put together on my behalf, which was just an incredible act of generosity. And I've been overwhelmed by the hospitality of folks. Everyone except for this one bison that was more than nonplussed when we came around the curve, and he definitely owned the road. But aside from that fellow, I think it was all good. So anyways, I just want to say thank you very much. This is undoubtedly, as Les has spelled out for us, a critical moment, and a critical moment for our democracy, very much an important political discussion. But it's also something that is resonating around the world. I came across this quote the other day from someone saying, we are living in the fake news era, as you know. Everyone knows it. Any guess? I mean, it's not the president. But it is a president. It was President Bashar al-Assad who said that. Probably for many of you, it's not shocking to have seen the way that the fury around fake news has spread around the globe. Fake news is a term that's being bandied about in Belarus, Cambodia, China, Myanmar, Singapore, Indonesia, Venezuela, the list goes on and on and on, Russia, Kazakhstan. And there's a reason for that. And that's what I would like to try to focus on a little bit tonight, is to get at that. Because it was also sort of surprising to me to note that PolitiFact, the fact-checking organization, found that they could find no instance of a foreign leader using the term fake news before 2016. Thank you, Mr. President. There's no question that this has been a term. Now, it's not correct to say that the forces behind that haven't been true for a long time. The idea or the notion of taking false information and propagating it widely in order to mislead a public, that's not new. But the popularization of the term and the way that we've seen it spread in such a short period of time, less than 2 years, is an incredible phenomenon. So why has it had this purchase? Why has it cropped up in so many places? And I think to understand that, I think it's really important to understand the nature of authoritarianism today. For several years, I was working on this book called The Dictator's Learning Curve, where I spent several years in a variety of different authoritarian countries: Venezuela, China, Russia, Egypt, Malaysia. And in each of these places, I was primarily focused on meeting with two groups of people. One, with people in the government, people that were perpetuating the political system that existed there. That could mean political advisors, cronies, people in the business sector, military. And then the other group that I was spending time with was people who were trying to overthrow the government. And what I was trying to look at is how both sides learned from each other and the strategies that they used. And one of the sort of central observations that I had was that today's, when I found from really talking to people and spending time and doing this reporting, was that today dictators, modern dictators, authoritarians, would-be strongmen, they understand that in a globalized world, that the brutal means of intimidation, mass arrests, firing squads, violent crackdowns, are best replaced by more subtle forms of coercion. So what do I mean by that? I mean that if there is an NGO that is trying to challenge you on the human rights side, you don't. It's very backward to sort of just make all these people disappear. It makes much more sense to have a tax inspector pay them a visit on a Tuesday afternoon. You'll look at the paperwork, you'll find that, oh, incredibly, the paperwork is, something is out of line here, and the organization can be shuttered. You can use a legalized process to accomplish that aim. Health inspectors are much more useful than goon squads in these cases. Laws are written very broadly, and then they're used like a scalpel against those that the government deems to be a threat. So, for example, in Venezuela, people, activists would tell me, you know, really the motto of this country, Chavez's model, Chavez was in power at the time, should be, for my friends, everything. For my enemies, the law. In these contexts, you don't shutter all media. That's actually not very useful. And you want to control television. Sure, you want to control major organs of the media. But it's important to still allow a little bit of flexibility for smaller actors. Why? One, it's useful to have a means for people to let off some steam. It's also useful to get information, because a big problem is actually getting accurate information within an authoritarian society. So, for example, in China, no friend to press freedom, they have allowed a certain amount of latitude for financial journalists. Why? The party knows that they face endemic corruption. They need to know who's egregiously corrupt. Journalists are good for that. And so allowing a little bit of space for financial journalism was a way to get information that the party otherwise might not get. And then, of course, there's elections. Every strongman or modern authoritarian holds elections. Now, you could say that's not particularly interesting or new. You know, the Soviet Union had elections. Brezhnev would win with 99% of the vote. Yes, but that's idiotic, right? Because the result itself gives away the crime. No one wins with 99% of the vote. I mean, it's the whole thing is a charade, right? So a modern authoritarian understands that the only election worth stealing is one that appears to be contested. So you win with 70% of the vote. 70% is the new 99. You know, and so it's these types of nuances, it's in these ways that the modern authoritarian is much more savvy and sophisticated than maybe some of his forebears. Enter fake news. Why criminalizing fake news is obviously an incredibly appealing tool for those in these situations. Why? You immediately are able to target your critics, to lash out at your critics. You can rally your base, right? On top of that, it undermines what democratic institutions still exist. And in many of these places, the reality is most of those pillars have been displaced or are corrupt. You're not likely to get justice at the courthouse, right? And the opposition party could just be an appendage of the state. So journalists are maybe, in many cases, the last bastion of some sort of accountability, some sort of fact-finding and information sharing. Eliminate that, and there's not much left. That you can do that, and also say that the inspiration, the term that you now use, was popularized by someone in the United States, makes it all the more attractive. You've found a way to create moral equivalency between yourself and the United States. The term itself is legitimated by the fact that it's mentioned hundreds of times over the course of what has only been 2 years. So all of these become very effective tools, and I think it's really important. I mean, the question is, it's not behind me still, but can democracy survive? It's not just a question for the United States. It's a question for democracies and for authoritarian states that we have, in many cases, have written off as being that way, although there are still people in those places who are trying to make it a more pluralistic society. So there's a lot for us to talk about here, but I do think it's important for us to remember that this is something that's resonating not just here, but thousands of miles away. And it's important that we recognize just how fragile that is, because while these, I agree with what Les said in terms of the existential threat that's posed here, and maybe some number of elections to come could be instrumental, but this is happening in the here now. There's an immediacy to this that is being felt in other parts of the world that I think we could learn a lot from. So I'll stop there.
Thank you. I'm headed out to get your book. And Jeff, your thoughts about fake news, free speech.
And I ditto everybody else, thank you. And I'm gonna take more of a tech person's perspective on this. Fake news is generally identified with the right accusing the left. The left has terms of the right about their version of fake news. I think the big question for us is why are we more afraid now? Is that based on data? Is it true? If this has been going on for the 300,000 years now, we think that Homo sapiens have been around, why are we more afraid now? Why is democracy almost at its end? I'm just gonna give you, my expertise is in computers and it's, what an honor to be here with you and learn from you, and iron sharpens iron. But I'm gonna talk a little bit about the tech side that you may or may not know about. So the phrase computational propaganda was coined at the Oxford Internet Institute at Balliol College in Oxford. The phrase describes the mixing of algorithms, automation, and human creation to manipulate perceptions, affect cognition, and influence behavior. So these computer algorithms we're talking about used in artificial intelligence and machine learning that you see around you today, there are hundreds of different types. There's not just one. And then when you combine all those different types, you get this exponential effect. But the one thing they all have in common is this common goal of increasing the accuracy of a prediction. That's what we're trying to do with these AI algorithms. Those predictions can be used to know what a consumer might be interested in buying and then reinforcing that interest to drive a behavior, such as click on buy now, and better predictions can drive higher profits. The same technology is used to get voters to vote. Both political parties provide such digital services to its candidates, and as we all know, non-American entities are using it too, which is kind of the topic today. So this graph you see in front of you is the accuracy of three-day weather forecasts plotted from 1955 to 2005. In 1955, you were better off flipping a coin than relying upon NOAA for a three-day accurate forecast. Today, as we all know, we can go to our phones and, predict what we're going to do in Yellowstone for the next 5 days. A couple things happened in technology over the last two decades to increase the accuracy of our predictions, and this graph captures two of them. On the X and Y axis, the more data and the more compute you have, the more predictive accuracy you gain from your algorithms. But cheaper massive computers and storage, for example, didn't alone result in a world that now brings us virtual assistants like Siri, Google, Alexa, and Cortana. It took algorithms, certain types of algorithms that we loosely classify as AI. It's about as nebulous as a term as fake news. And I just want to demystify it a little for you. So if we plot the accuracy of AI algorithms against the old way of analyzing data, and I'm going to leave it generic here when I say old, we get this. If you're given more data and more computing power, neural network algorithms create much more accurate predictions than the old way of doing analysis. Ever since the creation of these algorithms, primarily in the 80s, large tech companies and foreign governments are in a war to acquire data. They want to own large data sets. So they're acquiring startups at very high valuations, or they're collecting their data on their own, or they're hacking it. Why? Because these algorithms get more accurate on larger and diverse data sets. Accuracy then makes your product better. Consequently, you get more customers. And before you know it, this positive feedback loop makes a business very defensible. It took basically 5 years of continuous recorded audio from over 1 million people to create the technology that drives Google, Alexa, Cortana, and Siri. It took that much data. That is hard for a local municipality to do, or a small press agency, or these are big, big institutions that are working on this. And if you leave with anything from my comments, it's this. Data on you is the new oil. So here are three ads that the Russian IRA used on Facebook. The first one, if you were a New Yorker supporting a group that mimicked Black Lives Matter, you got this ad, "Not my president," with an X through Donald Trump's face. And it targeted different things. Here's another ad on the right. A New Yorker supporting Trump, or left, depending on perspective. This is the ad you got. So this is the IRA. These are two ads they did on Facebook. Here's the third one. Free online music library. It had nothing to do with the left or the right. So why would you do that? Why would a foreign evildoer want to recommend these different types of ads? To gather more data. Why? So they can test various combinations of AI algorithms to increase the accuracy of their predictions about your behavior. Whether it be in politics or business, the goal of mass data collection is the same: to increase the accuracy of predictions. On August 1st, 2018, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence had a public hearing asking experts to testify on how foreign actors use social media to meddle in the American political process. Five various experts testified. They all agreed this is an information war. So these tactics are ongoing, and both sides are going to evolve. One thing we don't need right now is for government and tech companies to go in their corners. We need them to work together. Plus, our elected officials must achieve a much higher IQ in technology and these algorithms. And regardless of how you feel about tech platforms, eradicating misinformation while preserving free speech is a monumental challenge for them in this age. I personally hope that tech platform companies will become another non-governmental balance of power in America, similar to what we see in the press, while respecting, you know, free speech. Call me naive, but at least admit that democracy needs all of the help it can get. Why? In March 2018, an MIT study of fake news showed that AI bots have equanimity when it comes to contested stories, while humans decisively prefer to spread lies over truth. In particular, we appear to like and share the lies that shock and disgust, arousing our bodies in opioid-like ways. More so than computers, our most ancient appetites may be our undoing. Trolled people troll other people. And I think we'd all agree it sounds like an all-hands-on-deck moment for democracy. Thanks.
Thank you. What a way to kick off some very thoughtful comments and discussion. And remember, now you have these cards being passed out for you to write your questions on. And then when you've finished writing, raise your hand so they can be collected. And while they're doing that, I get to ask a few questions of our panelists. And I think, given where we ended, I would start with this. There's a new book by communications professor Kathleen Hall Jamieson, who shows empirical evidence that there was misinformation thrown into the last election cycle and that it moved the dial everywhere by a few points, which makes a difference in those states where those few points were the variance or very close calls and could have had an influence within 1 to 3% percentage points on the outcome of the election. Evidence indicates that this is what happened, and I want to know from each of the three of you, what do you make of that problem and how can we address it? Can it be addressed?
I would agree. They're clearly more, like if we just use Facebook, right? YouTube was a big participant in, or I guess, part of the fake news platform. And you could see where more ads were targeted to certain states, so there's no question about it. Is tonight the first World Series game? So I would say it's like the first game in the World Series. Like They are collecting data, and they is everybody. It's Google, it's Russia, it's you name it. They are collecting data, and they are figuring out how to make their AI algorithms more predictive on your behavior so they can influence. So 1% to 3%, yeah, I would say that may be a minor success. They're trying to get far bigger than that in terms of how they can influence.
Care to weigh in, Les?
Will, do you want to go first? I'm not going to be able to give a technological answer. I will say that I am totally convinced that there was that involvement by a hostile foreign power. What to do about it is more difficult. If we knew what to do about it, we wouldn't have it going on right now, and it's going on in these midterm elections from various sources. I do think, as someone who was on the Defense Appropriations Committee, that anti-cyber research should be done. My colleague over here on my left can talk about and can verify whether that's a useful solution or not, but to a policymaker like me, that's one. You can't launch a missile against the Kremlin. You can't demand that they stop. It's too fluid. I mean, it's obvious. It's on the face of it. So to me, I think absolutely it's happened. Two, I think counter cyber is very, very important. And rather than spending trillions of dollars on hypersonic missiles, which some of you may have heard about this morning on NPR, which is a new proposal, which will cost trillions and be very destabilizing, I'd rather see the money go to anti-cyber defenses.
I mean, I would say a couple things. One, in the immediate aftermath of some of these revelations, there was a movement to a call of action for people to drop their Facebook accounts or to stop using social media to try to somehow punish the companies. One of the things that really struck me about that was, thinking from an international perspective, was the degree to which that it can be a fine act for someone to perform in many places, but in many parts of the world, it isn't a stretch to say Facebook is information. Facebook is media. To ask people to actually abandon that platform is to basically ask them to just stick their head in the sand. It's not an option. Maybe it's not Facebook in this place, maybe it's WhatsApp in another place. But the point is that these platforms have now, it's not just a means for you to keep up with your high school friends and to look at people's new puppies. It's everything. And so that's not actually an operational, realistic solution. Not that it necessarily was something that caught fire. I don't know how many people gave up their Facebook accounts in this room. But the point is that even thinking along those lines is really not thinking seriously about the problem, which at the end of the day, I think comes back to people being very intelligent consumers of news and information. I mean, I had a family member who was sharing information that was clearly false. And it doesn't really matter if the person is conservative or liberal. It was happening on both sides. And at some point in time, I think what we're facing here is a perfect storm of factors. It's, which I think in a way we've all just commented on, it's the weaponization of information through the democratization of technology. It's a lack of faith and trust in institutions, and I would say in this case, journalistic institutions that people once had faith in are lacking. The stat that Les mentioned earlier. And then also, it's just the political tribalism. It's not so much, people aren't so much interested in whether the information is true or not. It's whether or not it's a point for their team. And those three forces coming together at this moment, I think, is what makes this an all hands on deck problem.
Thanks, Will. That plays right into one of the good questions we just got from the audience, so I'm going to come back with that one. We've been talking about fake news and it originating as a term in the United States in 2016 with the current president, who's a Republican slash conservative. This question says, I find that many liberals profess to be open to divergent opinions, but in reality, they are just as tribal as conservatives. In other words, they are receptive to any point of view so long as it aligns with their own. Does the panel agree?
Yes. I mean, I think that's, you know, I think that's the point of political tribalism, is that, in fact, what you're seeing is people breaking themselves off into camps. So I don't think there's any question that you've seen this on both sides, and it's what is making it so difficult for there to be civil conversations between people. And people are very siloed in their information. It's difficult for me to see people only choosing to have one or two sources of information, given the multiplicity of options that are out there. And I think too often those choices are really, they're preordained. There's a confidence in the outcome or the information that will be shared that leads you to go back to that source. So I think that there's truth in that.
Les.
Yeah, I agree that the Republicans are guilty of that, but not my Democrats. No. I agree with Will. I do agree with Will. And I agree with his term, and I think I used it in my remarks too. We have broken up into tribes. And we've used language as weapons to fight a war for an informational war to win political power. And what's missing, what's happening is we're not listening to understand. We're listening to react. And therein lies a real difference. I think it's not just the professionals in the in parties. I think it's all of us. So rather than thinking that non-politicians are necessarily a day at the beach, because you aren't, let's think about our viewing habits. What most Americans do today, and maybe they do it around the world, well, I don't know. But what we do in this atomized news environment here in America tends to be dialing into news sources, quote unquote, that we agree with, and dialing out those that we don't. And so thus armed, we go back to our tribe and we fight these battles. And I've seen intolerance on the left as well as on the right, for sure.
Thank you. Jeff, did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I mean, of course, I agree with that too. For me, I frame the problem differently. So if you take YouTube, they have 2 billion viewers. That's more than any religious ideology in the world. If you think of religion as a tribe, right, and probably the most successful tribe to date by population numbers, you know, they've kind of proven that. YouTube has 2 billion of them. What you need to understand about the algorithms is, I think this notion of 18th century humans have free will and are rational beings and markets are rational, I think we got to throw that out the window, at least start with the fact that all of us as an evolutionary species have tricks in our brain that are played against us that can get manipulated. The difference today versus then, it can be done at massive scale at one particular instant. And we haven't, as a species, figured out how to deal with a viral incident that can get an entire town, you know, somewhere in the middle of the world turned upside down in 24 hours. That's the challenge facing us, not the admission that there are tribes everywhere.
That also segues into another one of our great questions from the audience here. With the compilation of technology, increased globalization, economic change, and the culmination of past events, including the removal of the fairness doctrine and the rise of 24-hour news cycles, do you think this period of time was destined to happen?
Uh, I'll jump in very quickly, Will, and then pass it off to you to correct me. I don't believe in predestinations, but I do. I've always felt that one of the worst things that ever happened to our society from an information standpoint is the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine, which gave equal time in our public airways. We own those airways, and for them to be so commercialized that one side can turn out to be a whole network that turns out to be a veritable subdivision of a major political party in this country, to me seems wrong. So I think when Reagan dropped the Fairness Doctrine, it was a very, very bad mistake.
I'm gonna have Will comment on this, but agreed. Would you comment on probably what I think is a bigger issue right now is that tech companies aren't treated like media companies?
Well, I mean, you know, to me, it's hard to see how technical companies aren't media companies. I mean, it's very difficult. I mean, in the lack of regulation there, it does strike me as, again, think about what I just said earlier, that the way that tech companies effectively operate as media companies in many parts of the world, I mean, that to me is just sort of the most basic de facto evidence of what they have evolved into being. Now, they do many other things besides that, and they have many different revenue streams besides what is a fairly simplistic model that is a media company in its traditional sense. So, but to me, I think we're sort of sticking our heads in the sand if we don't see them for being the purveyors of information and news that they've become.
And there was a step in that direction with the laws against ISPs being able to back away from any child pornography and sex trade stuff.
Why don't you explain what ISPs are for the audience?
Just your network, basically. So Comcast, anybody. If they're just a pipe that's transmitting data to you, I'm sure some of you read about, you know, the fact that you have these black networks, black web networks that do child porn on a massive scale and sex trade stuff that it's really hard to crack the security behind them. Well, the Comcasts of the world didn't have any liability towards that. And the GOP and the Dems sat down together and finally said, look, there's some common ground. Enough's enough, right? Children are off limits in America. The next step in that evolution is just, you know, I hate to use the word truth and false, but if we all agree that fake news is bad, whether you're left or right, if you hold these tech companies to similar standards that ABC News has, right, that they could be sued if someone published something fake on their platform, that is the debate we're really here to talk about. How do you keep free speech but hold them to some level of accountability? Well, our nation has moved in that direction if you're just looking at child pornography laws and holding them accountable to that. Is the next step fake news? You know, is that something we all agree to as a nation that isn't good?
Can I jump in? I just have to say that the idea that we would legislate against and have it stand a constitutional test against the informational lies is just very far-fetched for me. We have a constitutional doctrine that's now set by this Supreme Court that spending money on candidates in unlimited amounts is freedom of speech. Well, if that's the case, it's not hard for me to see the same court, same judiciary, saying, well, it's free speech to peddle a lie. So I'm sorry, I don't agree with your remedy, but I just had to make that point.
I love it when you fight. Will.
I would say that some of this feels very theoretical right now, and I think that the dangers, the temptations, and the Pandora's box that you open up when you start trying to regulate free speech, it doesn't have to be theoretical for us entirely, because it's actually something that other governments are trying to do. It's a step that others are taking, and these may seem like extreme examples, but in the case. Because of the nature of that speech, that it's fake news that's being shared on social media platforms, it's not Well, it's certainly not a theoretical threat for international journalists. There are countries in this world now that if we report the news factually, because of the way the laws have been written, that if it offends the powers that be, we are open to being arrested. And it doesn't matter whether you're a U.S. journalist or a Malaysian journalist in Malaysia, you can be a foreign national and still run afoul of that. What does that mean for us? How do we have to approach our job differently? Do we approach our job differently? And it's not just sort of a problem for journalists alone, because of the nature of the medium, if someone else retweets or shares that story that we produced that later is deemed to be offensive to the government because it exposes corruption in the government, for example, then the people who share those stories can also be imprisoned. Egypt didn't take very long to pass a fake news law, and they're very clear in how they view these questions that we're debating. If you have more than 5,000 followers, you are a media company in Egypt today.
Just one more thought, and I'll make it brief rather than prolong this. We as Americans, we have a tendency, maybe it's a human tendency, to want to reach for some mechanism. Maybe it's the law. Let's pass a statute, solve our problems, rather than do the work ourselves. And I think the work ourselves that we have to do here is the surest one, and that is going back to what I was trying to say at the beginning, and that's doing the hard work of checking our sources, seeing how valid they are, looking for logical fallacies. That's that kind of critical thinking. There's no better remedy than that, and I certainly would prefer that to the kind of statutes that could lead to what Will was just describing.
Thanks, Les. I'm going to turn to a more positive note here for a minute. We've been through child pornography and the repression of journalists in Egypt and so forth. What are some success stories about maintaining freedom of speech while combating fake news? Does anyone have success stories to tell us? Next question, should I just move on?
I can talk about what tech companies do, success stories, and that's why I hinted at, I think they can be like the press. I think they can be a positive good for society. I frame this issue, so truth is a difficult word, but if on the x-axis we have truth, and on the y-axis we have intent to manipulate, and you break that into four quadrants, obviously on the bottom right, where you're fully truthful and you're not manipulating anybody, that's like God, right? Perfect, right? In the bottom left, if you're wrong and you're just stupid and wrong, but you're not trying to manipulate, you're just wrong. Okay, we don't really have a problem with that in America. You can be wrong and speak all you want. As soon as you go up that intent to manipulate, that's where the problems start. So we've had, you know, hoaxes going on in human society forever, where you're wrong and you're trying to manipulate, where it really gets gray. I think tech companies are getting really good at the right and the hoaxes. We're getting good at figuring out who's hoaxing and using intent to manipulate as a mechanism to use these AI algorithms to lower that in the ratings. Because we're working on that MIT study that as much as you might, you know, want to believe that the entire world is perfectly rational and you can educate them all, it's not true right now. And so if we can manipulate them, how can we as a platform company prevent that? Well, getting rid of hoaxes is one good way, and we're getting better at that. We don't want to mess with right and wrong, right? You can be right and wrong all day long, just keep doing it. It's that top right quadrant where you're manipulating and you're true in some way. So you're cherry picking stats, you know, I call it propaganda. That is a difficult thing for us to capture, but I think on the hoaxes side, you're seeing it change in stack rankings and in ads and stuff.
I can jump in here. I don't know how many success stories I can point to, but I think that there are ways which this phenomenon is an entirely negative one, in that it can affect the behavior of media companies and media organizations. And I think that can be really important. And it's at least it's not going to solve this because, as we were saying earlier, there are a number of facets to it, both in our politics and elsewhere. But for media companies, I think there are things that media companies can do. And so, you know, what I can speak to is the places I've worked and specifically where I work now. I mean, one very important thing, I think, is that you show your work. I mean, that's just, you're taught that in school. Like, it doesn't matter if you've got the right answer. How did you get there? What that means to me in practice is that if you are, you know, if you're putting together a story and you got it wrong, it's really important now that you explain why you got it wrong and how you got it wrong. You gotta own up to your mistakes. That's critical because you're asking for people's trust. We have a person in our newsroom, in the center of our newsroom, the standards and practices editor, and his job is to make sure that we own up to those things. And then we have a separate person, and I think this is another element you need, sort of an independent auditor. And in what we call that is an ombudsman. And she is there reporting on us. I can get a phone call from the ombudsman, and it's not because she wants to, you know, chat. She wants to interview me. Now, she's got an office in our building, but she reports directly to the CEO. She's outside of the newsroom, reporting on the newsroom. And that's an advocate, and that's a wonderful source for people who've heard something or read something on NPR that they disagree with or that they think was wrong, to go to that person and to raise it. So I think that's important. We've taken the step of making sure that we label everything. There's so much, and you know, I think a lot of it would have been obvious, but there's so much information coming at people now that I think it's really important that you label something as, it's a very simple thing to do, to label this as, this is commentary, this is reporting, so that people understand that you're not passing off your opinions as being news. You can do that much. That's not that hard. Before I was at NPR, I was at a publication called Slate, and I thought we had a wonderful practice where, first of all, we'd aggressively make our corrections. If there was a mistake, the correction went on that story, and it went on it fast. Anything else you were doing was no longer as important as getting that correction up. And we did it in a way so that we didn't just say that this, there was no passive voice. We said the name of the person who made the mistake. So if it was the writer, then we said, you know, so-and-so wrote this and they got it wrong. If it was me, if it was the writer had it right and then in my editing, I was the one who introduced the mistake, then it's William Dobson, da, da, da. You know, there it is. Boy, that really makes you want to not get it wrong again, right? And then at the end of the week, and this was the best part, on Fridays, it was a tradition that we always published all the mistakes we made that week as a separate article. You don't bother with having to go through and find all the individual mistakes that are attached to each story and everything. You can just wait till Friday and you can see all the mistakes we made and we'll highlight them for you. I mean, that's the way I think people should operate, because then you know that what you're reading is something you can actually share and pass on.
Thank you. I have a question from a teacher, I think, and I'm partial to teachers, so I'm going to ask that question. How do we counter political illiteracy and implement critical thinking? We have failed so many people in teaching the skill of critical thinking. I work in the Bozeman Public Schools. Do you have specific examples of what we can do for students and their parents?
That sounds like it was aimed at me. I'd be happy to respond. I don't have specific examples. Both of my granddaughters, by the way, one has graduated from Bozeman High. The other one is in the process of graduating if she finishes her finals. I think that we all ought to be involved. There's no one mechanism we can push, a lever we can push to make it all right. Cesar Chavez said, don't look for a man on the white horse. Here the people do the work. And this is what it really comes down to in this thing. When it comes to education and encouraging critical thinking, how many times have we gone to the school board and asked questions about the curriculum? What role does civic education play in the Bozeman Public Schools, in the junior high, in the high school? Are there funding problems? If there are funding problems, let's do something about it. You know, we need to be involved. How many people go to school board meetings? How many people, get involved in curriculum discussions? These are the things we need to work on. And it comes down to us, what we do. We need to be public citizens. We need to take charge of our own schools. They are our instruments for our children. And to me, that's the test. I don't know of any particular great examples. They're out there. And I'm sorry you're disappointed locally. I've heard some great things about the public schools in Bozeman. But that's what I would say. It's really up to us. Don't look for somebody else to do it. Don't look for the teachers to do it. Is there a funding problem? Then let's get organized and pass a ballot measure that gives the resources to the schools that they need. Okay.
I mean, there's some simple things I do think that you can look for, and I always point out to people and recommend. Is the person in the place that they're writing about? You should look at that. If the person is writing something and it's about events happening in some other part of the world and they're not actually there, that's a problem. I mean, that's what's really important about funding your member stations and NPR is that we actually send people to those places. The dateline, if you're reading a story in the paper, the dateline can tell you a lot. And you should start there because it's telling you whether or not that person is actually in Moscow or not. If they're not, an alarm should go off and you should begin to think, wait a minute, this may be someone passing off someone else's work, which can be okay, but it's going to require a higher level of scrutiny on your part to evaluate what you're going to hear next. Or is this person making an argument? That's okay. Argumentation is fantastic as long as it's clear that it's an argument and it's not a facts about what Vladimir Putin is or is not doing. You can take with much more credence the fact that that person has actually invested in going to that place, even better, lives there and has sources and is working that story all the time. Unfortunately, in my line of work in international news, there are about 4 companies left that still do that. NPR happens to be one of them.
I, in preparation for this evening's symposium, did receive an article. I'm happy to share it with the teacher who put that question up, and it's by 2 MSU researchers about how to teach students to become literate in critical reading of social media sources. So there's something being done.
Yeah, I would add to that. If you do not figure out how to get these tech companies doing the things you want them to do for your children, they already have rolled all over you. You can just look at how much time kids spend on phones, right? And that was my industry. So we weren't really debating, I wasn't debating about whether there should be free speech. What I was debating is there a level of accountability these tech platform companies have since you're the one bankrolling the internet for them? And if education doesn't catch up at the local level, at our local levels, they are at the university levels, with this digital transformation, they're going to keep losing. So the more I'm putting on my tech hat saying as a former teacher, the more we can take control of our youth's digital future or have a serious say in it, you know, the more, you know, we can raise thoughtful, educated, you know, rational children, because they are spending a lot of time on their phones and on their computers, and we know how to manipulate them.
And we have such good questions. I'm going to combine 2 questions into one. The first is fears being used to intimidate and influence the way people think and make decisions. How can we counter the fear strategy? And the other is hate speech the same thing as free speech, and should it be protected? Fear and hate speech.
Let me speak to hate speech. I think there are judicial precedents, if I'm not mistaken, that have deemed hate speech to be of a category that can be regulated without doing violence to the First Amendment, much as calling out fire in a loaded theater. So I think hate speech is in a category by itself and can be regulated, and there is an interest on the part of the government in the name of the public to regulate it.
How do we counteract the fear, the use of fear to manipulate the emotions of the consumer?
Yeah, I think we've got a problem on the fear side. I mean, that was a great answer on hate speech. I mean, philosophically, anyway, the fact that you could say that you're against hate speech or for hate speech means you're for regulating speech, period. So we've got to work through that issue as a society and agree to what our morality is. On the fear side, that MIT study, I'd really encourage you to read it, because we are predisposed to spreading bad things, for lack of better words. We are predisposed to do that. So that is, and we kind of all agree, like, we don't really want bad things. So it's ironic that our minds evolved like that. So we've got to work hard at doing that. Will brought up two things that we're doing in the tech industry is, you can find out hoaxes really easy by looking at how many sources they publish and by how many times they correct themselves. So we can scan all electronic news and use, you know, these algorithms to figure out who's really playing fairly from a intent to manipulate standpoint. So there's some really tactical things. I think what these tech companies need from you as local citizens is support, because they're going to get smashed on the free speech issue as soon as you know that their algorithms are manipulating free speech. By definition, when you go to Google and type in a search term, it is ranked, right? That is manipulating free speech. That's what they do for advertising dollars. So they need some air cover from you to use some of those techniques that we'd all agree are, like, who wouldn't want the source police coming around and checking on you? So give them some.
I think you got at this, Will, a little bit in your comment about the regulations in Egypt. If you have 5,000 followers, you become a public media source. One of the questions our audience asks is, how would you police fake news? I often see fake news on Facebook for vaccines, for and against vaccines and supposed science behind it. What if the truth is shut down because both sides are shut down?
For me, that goes back to what Les was saying. Like, wrong and right is not what we're talking about here. It's the intent to deceive. And so we as tech companies can use these algorithms to say, okay, you're saying this pill does whatever, right, for you. And you might be wrong about that, right? Because it can't be proven, right? So you're wrong, but it can't be proven. But what are you doing that for? Why are you advertising that? What amount of dollars are you making? Those are things we can go dig into. And what I'm seeing success in is this notion of transparency. And it is a big debate for privacy. My belief is with some of these tech platforms, the less privacy, not for the user, but for the advertisers you have, what's happening is there's a balance, there's an unproportionate weight on the consumer where your information is a free-for-all, right? We're using it. We can figure you out from five things. We know where you're at. We probably can figure out your cell phone number. The advertisers, it's almost like the total opposite. Put them in the same place you are. Expose them, like, be very transparent. So Facebook just recently put a webpage you can go to that sees all the political advertising dollars that are spent. And I pulled it up before I came in here today, and I looked at the top 10, and the first one was a Democrat from Texas, second one was a Trump PAC, and number five was Exxon. I was like, Exxon? Why did Exxon spend so much in the last week at Facebook? And you know, you could dig into it and figure out, well, there's a Prop 1650 in Colorado trying to restrict oil and gas leases. So it's this sort of transparency that I think will help in that get to the truth and maybe let consumers make their own decision that that pill doesn't make my hair grow.
I mean, I think it's an interesting phenomenon too on just the, I mean, you're talking about huge forces, corporate entities and funding. I mean, I think it's also, to me, it feels like the internet made a decision for anonymity a long time ago, and I feel like that maybe is something that should be reconsidered. At the individual level, it's, I think that it's a lot easier to say hateful things, provoke fear when you're, Grand Canyon 257, you know? I mean, Grand Canyon 257 can say anything he wants. But when his name is Jack, you know, and he's a known person, then I think all of a sudden he's back in the public square, and the way that he interacts at his local grocery store is probably a better indication of how he's going to act online. And I think that's probably to the good.
Thank you. Thank you. Several questions have pointed in this direction, so I'm going to ask one of those that I had prepared in advance. We have truth in advertising regulations. That means essentially we get more accurate information about laundry detergent than our political candidates. Is that right? Should it be that way? If free speech in advertising commercial products can be restricted by the FCC because the bandwidth is a public good, can't it be restricted in a similar way regarding the content of political ads? Why don't we hold them to the same standard?
I think there is that difference. The detergent is, contents is certainly more regulated than information about candidates. I draw a distinction between commercial information, commercial products, and getting into the question of who, regulating the information about political figures. I guess I'm all right with that last thing as long as I'm the one who makes the regulations of the political figures. And I'll bet everyone in the room would like to be in that spot too. But the point is, no one trusts any one person to be in that spot. So I don't think we can make the comparison between a box of detergent and a political figure. We've got, again, to do the hard work ourselves. The man on the white horse is not going to come in and do it for us. Here the people do the work. We do the work.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think at the end of the day, you have to work for your democracy, and you have to put these. They are asking for a tremendous trust and a tremendous role, and they. My understanding was that you were supposed to pass through a crucible to earn that trust, and so I think that it's really on the public to demand that. And having not seen something, then that is an answer in itself. If you can't get answers to your questions, then that's probably a warning sign.
T study I quoted is true. It correlates straight to why Democrats and Republicans use the same sort of hate speech ads against one another. I mean, you're trying to, the cheapest advertising dollar ever spent is word of mouth, right? So what we're trying to do in the tech industry is to use viral technology so that we don't have to pay money to do the advertising. And I think that happens, it is part of our political system today. So anything we could do to force more sources to be exposed in a political ad, or all the sorts of things advertisers need, I think is fair game. And it should be, I would demand it.
Les, you had another comment you wanted to...
Yeah, I was thinking further about, and this has been a great discussion tonight. I think this audience is fantastic. You owe yourselves a shout-out and a round of applause. You may not give it to yourselves, but you owe it to yourselves. There is a lot of truth in the fact, as Jeff was saying, that fear is a great motivator, and therefore we see it exploited. You can see it exploited in politics, you can see it exploited in international affairs, and you can see it exploited this year in this current election, as in previous elections and probably future ones. But it isn't always the case. It's not an absolute. I want to share a story that actually happened in Oregon. The man I lost a Senate race to in 1992, Senator Bob Packwood, had to resign his seat because of him being at in 1994, I guess, voted by the Ethics Committee of the Senate to be expelled because of being a serial sexual abuser. In the contest to replace, special election to replace him, there was a very, very talented Republican state Senate minority leader running against a Democratic U.S. congressman. And the Democratic congressman was Ron White, and I'll use his name because he did this. They were banging each other viciously in the special election, a short time frame, and it was really getting nasty. At least it was nasty in the terms of, in those days. It would be like patty cake today. But Ron Wyden did something really very interesting about 4 weeks out from the election. He held a press conference, and he said, I'm stopping all my negative political ads against my opponent. I'm talking only about positive issues that I care about and that I'm going to do for the people of Oregon. And the polls turned around immediately. It was about neck and neck. Wyden pulled out a huge lead, and he's still a ranking senator today, ranking Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee. The public responded. So fear can provoke and can manipulate and cause us to respond, but so can the opposite. It's what we demand. If we demand something different and give that kind of paycheck to the candidate who refuses to engage in some of that stuff, then we'll see a beginning of a change of behavior. Now that's simple. It's going to be very difficult to do, but it has happened, and it can happen again. And I just want to make sure that historical moment is noted tonight, so that no one goes away thinking that fear is the only motivator in American politics. It isn't.
Thank you so much. And actually, that anticipated one of the questions that came from our audience about why campaigns are so negative. So in wrapping this up, and quite a few of the questions that you have posed about what ordinary people can do and so forth are captured by this last question I'm going to ask our panelists to kick around. This week, Mike Allen of Axios wrote a little piece called Four Ways to Fix Fake News. He said, politicians stop using the term fake news on all sides. The media, he said, should ban their reporters from doing anything on social media, especially Twitter, beyond sharing their stories. The social media companies, he said, need to radically self-regulate or allow government regulation to staunch the flow of disinformation and made-up news. And finally, what can ordinary people do, he said, what we all need to do is quit sharing stories without reading them. So, with those, politicians stop using the term, media don't allow reporters to share anything but their own, but the stories as they are, social media radically self-regulate or get regulated, and we should stop sharing things we don't read. What do the three of you think about those proposals?
That sounds like the Garden of Eden to me, so that's great.
I don't agree with all of them. I agree with some of them, but I guess to make it more interesting, I guess the one that I don't agree with is the notion that reporters only share the stories.
That's right.
I mean, reporters are more than just that. I think it's actually, and I think maybe trying to bring it to a close, it's useful to point out that there are a lot of things that these tools are good for, and I think it's actually can be a very helpful means of engagement between your audience and in our case, the correspondent. I mean, there, we can be posed questions, and believe me, I've actually had civil conversations on Twitter. It has happened, and you know, someone came to me with a question, and it was a good question, and you try to explain, well, this is why we did it this way, and that I think that is that it can be a helpful dialogue. I also think that in many cases, people have invested a lot of time and energy in trying to learn a subject matter, to learn a place. And you know, I think there should be space to share that expertise and that knowledge aside from the thing that has your byline on it. So I don't agree with everything Mike said there, but I think in broad strokes, he makes good points.
Jeff, what's on your mind?
I agree. I mean, getting good people to do good things isn't the problem. It's the bad people that we're trying to deal with. So the regulation issue is the big question. Self-regulation is my interest. Things like anonymity. Like, why wasn't that? I mean, that to me is a bigger one. Like, all reporters cannot be, no reporter can be anonymous, right? You know, those sorts of debates, I think, do a lot more for the public good than, I mean, fake news will be called something else in 5 years. I called it a lie growing it up, you know, like
words. I've got a couple of words for it.
Yeah, both. Words change, right? But I think some of the topics we brought up are the ones you should hone in on for self-regulation of these companies, and then the delicate path of public regulation, right, without infringing upon free speech.
Well, I'd like to thank our panelists. Thank you.